Blog Talk Radio.
To you from the Blog Talk Radio studio right here in the heart of Hudson County. Ladies and gentlemen, you know it's always in Union City, New Jersey. Insider NJ proudly brings to you the three-time award-winning Politically Direct. And I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to thank you all for joining us here this week. Of course, I want to thank everyone listening throughout Hudson County, of course, throughout the Garden State, and certainly throughout the good old U.S. of A. Love all my listeners, and certainly with it being December and all, I do want to wish you in advance a very happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Festivus, you know, all that good stuff. And certainly want to thank you for being so supportive of the podcast here, folks, in 2020. Now, you're ready to the show's inbox at any time, ladies and gentlemen. It's politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Once again, if you have a suggestion for a guest or a topic, do write to me. I'd love to hear from you. I do answer my emails rather promptly. And once again, you can write to the show, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram, @politicallydirectnj, as well as my own Instagram, @ProfessorFernandoUribe. Tons of new likes. I mean, many new followers. And certainly, I appreciate all the support that you give me there on my social media, on Instagram specifically. I know many of you enjoy my Instagram stories, a little bit of pop culture, politically incorrect humor, funny memes, pro wrestling, sports, politics, everything. I know I put everything I possibly can within my Instagram stories. I know many of you enjoy them. I mean, I see the feedback in the commentary constantly. So I'm glad you enjoy everything you see on Instagram, folks. And also hit me up on Twitter, @ProfessorF. My Twitter feed's been a little busy lately, again, due to sticking up for Hudson County executives, sticking up for the Hudson County executive, Tom DeGees, this week due to all the social justice clowns and local woke fools harassing him. not just on social media, but for God's sakes, in front of his house, for the love of God. So I've been more than happy to, take the sword, as they say, and stand up for Tom DeGise. And also because I'm good friends with his daughter, Amy DeGise, the distinguished chairwoman of the Hudson County Democratic Organization. And Amy and I, besides her being a regular on my weekly podcast, Talking the Hudson, which she's a monthly guest, and she's been doing so since July of 2018, I've developed a friendship with Amy. I mean, she's a good person. Her dad's a good person. Her dad's been on my local podcast in Hudson County. He's a gentleman. So, a lot of the vitriol being directed at Tom DeGise, I think, is unwarranted. I think it's unnecessary. But what do you expect? These are meltdowns by children, who are supposed to be grown-ass men and women, and that's not the case. So certainly I've been a little busy on Twitter, sticking up for the county executive and also kind of sticking up for me. All these local idiots feel the need to opine and just, have their meltdowns about what's going on with the ICE contract in Hudson County. Jesus, take the L, move on, stop your bitching and moaning. There's more important things to be bitching and moaning about, especially for those of you that don't live in Hudson County and are either protesting or opining on social media. Like, really? You don't have anything else to worry about in your own house? Kind of annoying. But again, Twitter feed's been busy. Look me up on Twitter at Professor Afuribe. For all you Facebook subscribers, please go to the official page for Politically Direct on Facebook. Like it, of course. Tell your friends to do the same. And of course, 1,000 plus likes and counting. I must be doing something right, folks, because hey, traffic doesn't lie, and neither do I on this program. So I appreciate you guys tuning in here throughout 2020. And certainly, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, folks, by going to the website www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Nobody does it better, ladies and gentlemen, than Insider NJ, and certainly I'm proud to be partnering with them, hosting this show. Again, the first broadcast was in January of 2018. I did not know what to expect, okay, when I started hosting this show, and certainly I'm grateful to Insider NJ for having me on with them since January of 2018. Shout out to my boss, my insider GM, Pete O'Nelly, who I know I've given him some headaches sometimes, people writing to him or calling him directly about something that I said somewhere about something. And to his credit, my bosses at Insider NJ have stood by me because they know that I'm not bombastic. They know I'm not hyperbolic. They know I'm just really speaking up for all of you folks. All you regular working class everyday people that get tired of cancel culture, they get tired of this fixation on political correctness and everything else that I like to denounce and shoot down. So, again, a shout out to my Insider NJ boss, Pete O'Nelia. Again, I'm thankful for his faith in my abilities as, again, 2020 is closing up and we'll be starting off and we'll be doing year three basically here on the podcast. With Insider NJ, you can definitely check it out, all previous episodes at www.insidernj.com/podcast. And certainly we've had great guests since its first episode in January 2018. And three awards later, obviously I must be doing something right, despite what the haters may say throughout Hudson County or throughout the state of New Jersey. The results and the traffic speak for themselves, folks. So, I can't say, it wouldn't be possible without all of you because it wouldn't be. So I'm thankful to everybody who's helped make Politically Direct a success in 2020, and we'll continue doing it in 2021. And again, folks, again, don't forget to like Insider NJ on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. I would argue it's the best journalism anywhere in the state of New Jersey. Again, it starts at the very top with our editor-in-chief, Max Pizarro, who tends to piss me off sometimes with some of his annoying, leftist views. But, whatever. I'm sure I get it on his nerves. But we also have other great columnists there, Jay Lasseter, Fred Snowflack, even Alan Steinberg, who's a bit delusional too, but I enjoy reading stuff as well. And that's what makes us a great team at Insider, folks, a lot of diversity, both intellectually and ideologically. And again, that's why Insider NJ is the best news source for you each and every day, www.insidernj.com. Folks, as a reminder, and always very important, the disclaimer, the opinions and views expressed here and every week on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the journalists, the staff, or our sponsors. I always have to make sure I get that out there to not give my Insider NJ bosses any more headaches than they already get. So one less headache I can give them, that's always a good day. Well, folks, join us here this week, a great man in his own right and a guy who I had the chance to interview on my own local podcast on Wednesdays, Talking the Hudson, which you can listen to, by the way, at www.blogtalkradio.com/talkinghudson. He is the chief prosecutor for Hudson County's largest city, that is Jersey City, folks. He joins you this week on Plug It Direct. He's the great Jay Connett, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Counselor, what's going on, brother?
Hey, sir, how are you?
I'm doing well. Good. I'm doing well, Jake. And just before I forget, I want to wish you a happy holiday, happy Festivus, happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, you know, everything under the sun. So I want to wish that for
you
and your family. So definitely hope you have a great one. Jake, a lot to unpackage here. We'll get to some local things in a moment, but I sort of want to piggyback off of a great conversation we had on my local podcast recently. As my viewers know, my listeners know, excuse me, certainly on election day, New Jerseyans by a margin of 67% to 33% overwhelmingly told Trenton, hey, we want to be now the 13th state in the country to legalize marijuana recreationally for anyone over the age of 21. Governor Murphy, when he was candidate Murphy in 2017, ran on this issue, felt it was a good revenue stream. He also felt that there were components of social justice that he wanted to accomplish with this. That seems to be on the agenda, Jake, but as we've talked about on previous podcasts, and I've talked about it on my own show with other guests, you know, sometimes Trenton, you know, you can't always trust him to do the right thing with new revenue sources. And I'm hoping that that's the case here, that they're able to do what's right by people, especially black and brown people, from a criminal justice perspective. But I think also for those that are looking to be entrepreneurial, let's hope that it's going to be something that's easier to do in the Garden State. I want to hear your thoughts, Counselor.
Right. Well, I mean, everyone's banking on passage next week, but as you and I have talked about, there are no safe bets in New Jersey politics. I'm glad that it looks like we're headed in the right direction away from a very awkward January 1st, where, you know, this becomes constitutional, but maybe we wouldn't have a bill in place. The broad strokes of the legislation seem to make sense. I have seen some stakeholder groups pointing out that exact details have not been released, but I certainly think it looks like we're much closer to the goalpost today than we were when you and I last checked in on this not that long ago.
Oh, well, I like that reference. As a football fan, I like that reference. Well done, Counselor. Let me just unpackage this a little bit more, because I know that for my audience here, they're a little bit different than my local podcast, but let's sort of go back in time in a chronology, because I know that you have been one of the biggest advocates about decriminalization. I know that going back to the summer of 2018, you got on the radar of Attorney General Gabriel Gowal. I know you, along with Jersey Mayor Stephen Fulop, made headlines about what you were looking to do in Jersey City as it pertained to decriminalization. Obviously, as I said, the governor and more so the attorney general got wind of this. It got not tumultuous per se, but obviously I'm sure behind the scenes it might have been a little testy, or maybe some hostility was thrown your way. Obviously throughout that summer, the attorney general had put a moratorium on prosecutions. At least that's what he was directing municipalities to do. We were hoping that by Labor Day of 2018, we would have seen some progress on it. It came and went. Nothing happened. In the meantime, we kept incarcerating black and brown people at really exponential rates. And certainly in 2019, in March that year, I know the legislature convened. They didn't have votes to have it passed. And certainly State Senate President Steve Sweeney said, well, our next step is to put it as a ballot question. Well, we're not going to do it in 2019. Which would have made sense, I guess, to be expedient. But instead, the state Senate president said, no, we're going to put it on the ballot question for 2020. Okay, it came. Obviously, in the meantime, we're still incarcerating people. And obviously, it passed by a big margin. And now we sit where the legislature has to roll up their sleeves, get to work, and get this passed. Is that an accurate chronology on my part?
Absolutely. I think you nailed it. Yeah, that's the that's been the roller coaster ride of legalization in New Jersey.
Now, I'm not sure if you're willing to disclose this on the air, but
on a scale of 1 to 10, though, Jake, how hostile – maybe hostile is not the right word. How uncomfortable were conversations with the governor's office or the attorney general? Because I'm sure that you and Mayor Fulop, I'm sure, probably pissed them off to some extent because you made some headlines. Am I overblowing this, or was there some real heat?
Yeah, no, there was definitely heat. You know, the municipal court in Jersey City, which is the highest volume in the state, was told to pack up their marijuana complaints and summonses and send them up the street to the Superior Court, because the a county prosecutor and even the attorney general does have the ability to the attorney general can take over cases from a county prosecutor or a municipal prosecutor, and a county prosecutor can take over cases from a municipal prosecutor. So, you know, that had been initiated when we sat down. I think Renton thought when they fired off that first letter at me that, you know, I would rescind our policy. Don't think they knew a lot about my character. The mayor certainly did. But I was sort of a new face on the scene. And honestly, what municipal prosecutor expects to make statewide news? But when they called back his inner office, I think there was some, they were puzzled that I wasn't moved by his letter. But when we got to the table, there were meaningful conversations, and I still am grateful for where we landed and felt privileged to even be invited to the same table as him. Again, little old municipal prosecutor in Hudson County, being given the opportunity to sit across from the attorney general and have a discussion about a very serious topic. I'm very grateful that we decided to come to a resolution rather than, you know, take this through the court system.
Well, I mean, that's a great outlook, Jake. And one of the things that I was looking forward to having you on for the show was, again, sort of just a continuation from my local broadcast with you. Because on a state level, obviously, you know, with being with Insider and Jay, obviously our audience is a lot bigger. One of the things that really kind of concerned me, I think, about this legislation finally getting ironed out, you know, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, as you alluded to, obviously January 1st is Judgment Day, as they say. Where the legislature needs to have something in place. I mean, we can't have the Wild Wild West here in New Jersey. It's just that simple. And again, I'm not trying to engage in hyperbole here, but that's essentially what would happen if the way – and you mentioned this, I think, in a previous conversation where the ballot question was phrased in such a way where, yes – and I even said this to my students who I talk to virtually, obviously, when I'm having class. I said to them, like, hey, listen, by the way, guys, yeah, most likely this is going to pass by a big margin in New Jersey on Tuesday, November 3rd. Just do me a favor. Don't go out on your front porch or walk down the street thinking you can just smoke now on Wednesday, November 4th, because it's legal. No, it still needs to go through the process of being regulated and everything else and taxed. You know, that's a favorite word in Trenton. That, you know, that has to be ironed out. I think it was a very different ballot question than the way it's been sort of worded with other states that went this route also, right, in the sense of a ballot question and the way it was legalized in other states. It was quite different, wasn't it?
I believe so. I mean, this, again, kind of was like watching a ping pong match. And originally it was the governor and the legislature, and then the legislature decided to make it the legislature and the voters, and for it to be placed in the voters' lap and then so quickly put back in the legislature's lap with a clock ticking, and this legislature of all legislatures operating under a clock, it certainly caused the potential for something very strange to happen in January. And again, we are not out of the woods yet. And I was just recalling a tweet that I saw the New Jersey ACLU put out on Wednesday, saying that there is a hearing on this on Monday, and the updated legalization bill, at least as of that tweet, have not been published yet. So that's sort of interesting because I know that, you know, the ACLU was involved in this very early. They were involved. They read my memo in 2018 before it was published. And for them to appear outside of the loop right now is interesting. And again, I don't think you and I should count any chickens just yet.
You know, that's a fair assessment. And I'm glad you brought up the ACLU of New Jersey up because I know that I've been fortunate enough to have Amol Sinha, the executive director, on a few times on this podcast. And also I had him on my Real Talk show with Eisen and Jerry. And we've had great conversations about this issue. And this is something, Jake, for me, it's a personal issue because before entering academia, I mean, I worked in our criminal justice system for 10 years. So I'm not just a career academic. It was just all about books. I mean, I worked in our jails. I mean, I worked at the Kearney Jail in Hudson County. I worked at the Essex County Jail in Newark. I mean, I, for years, during grad school, even out of grad school, like I would see consistently black, brown men and women just unjustly incarcerated for this. And, you know, people might say, Fernando, you seem very passionate about this issue. Like, how personal is it? Well, it's personal because, well, number one, I don't care about marijuana per se. Like, I don't smoke it. I never have. I never will. I don't care to. Like, my way of relaxation is right now after we finish recording, Jake, I'm going to sit down here with a nice glass of Malbec or maybe a Cabernet, depends on what I have in my shelf. I have a nice glass of red wine. That's my way of relaxing. Again, doesn't make me better than anybody. Doesn't make me worse. But I understand the therapeutic elements of marijuana. I understand the medicinal elements. And I understand it's an important issue. But for me more, it's been about the fact that I've seen people's lives ruined. I tell my students all the time, please, you got to be careful. Because you kids, you know, you run the risk of just having your lives destroyed by antiquated drug laws where you lose access to your loans, you're going to lose access to employment. It's just, it's catastrophic. And for me, the fact of seeing this now, I think, is justice. Again, I don't want to sort of go along the lines of what type of justice it is. It's just justice, period. And that's good to see, Jake. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And I'm glad you touched on what we call collateral consequences, because maybe somebody listening would say, how often does someone go to jail anymore on marijuana? And
a lot,
you know, that's right. But that's just one piece of it. You know, there's the, like you said, the loss of federal loans, the loss of subsidized housing, the loss of employment opportunities, the loss of the ability to join law enforcement or the military. Right. So it is good that, you know, it is interesting to watch, to be part of a shift, so to speak, that, you know, if we had talked about this 10, 20 years ago, when a lot of these laws were written and fine-tuned, no one would have imagined, you know, the public sentiment now where you have it polling, you know, strongly and then passing strongly. So it is nice to see, you know, this idea of justice on this issue come around.
Now, Jake, when it comes to marijuana, honestly, man, it just seems like there's a generational disconnect when it comes to discussing this. And I'll give you an example. Maybe you can add your own as well. I mean, when I try to talk about this, and my dad and other family members listen to my podcast weekly, and, you know, my dad's a 70-year-old, kind of, you know, old-school Latino male who's just, you know, hey, drugs are bad. I don't care what you want to justify, blah, blah, blah. And I remember, and I think my dad turned the corner, or I made him turn the corner, hopefully. It was a couple of years ago during the Super Bowl when there were some advertisements for alcohol, like there usually are, beer, whatever. And I said to my dad, hey, Dad, did you know that cannabis groups had submitted a proposal to the NFL before Super Bowl? Obviously, every company does that for commercials. And they were willing to pay, you know, millions of dollars for a 30-second ad about the benefits of medicinal marijuana. I'm like, why not? Like, and the NFL is just so antiquated, because I said, wait a minute, why wouldn't they want to advocate for this, where their players arguably are playing the most violent sport on the planet, maybe next to rugby or whatever, but, you know, instead of players perhaps being hooked on painkillers and pain medication, why not make this available so, A, it could be medicinal, B, You stop suspending players for marijuana violations, and see, it's just much, it's just healthier to have them use this than be, you know, hooked on Vicodin and pain pills. It just seems like it's a bad message. And I think it was that conversation, Jake, with my dad that kind of made him turn the corner. He said, wow, no one ever described that. And all of a sudden, my dad just quietly said, well, good job, professor. And I was like, well, Dad, this is commonsensical. I think, Jake, it goes beyond, I think, partisanship or anything. But I really think there's a generational disconnect that still exists about marijuana, Jake.
Yeah, I mean, well, first I want to say hi to Dad if he's listening. But two,
thanks, Dave.
You're absolutely right, and let's just hope people come around and look at it a new way, like you're able to convince your dad to. You know, it's interesting. My probably cheerleader during my arm wrestle with Trenton was my mother, and she's 71 today, so she was 69 then.
Happy birthday to your mom, Jake. Happy birthday.
You're welcome. No. She's not literally 71 today, but I was just trying to figure out how old she was then.
Okay.
But she was my biggest cheerleader, and we connected a few days before this election. She was filling out her vote by mail ballot, and she was like still decided on the constitution, undecided on the constitutional amendment. And I didn't bust her chops because I had no interest to, but I thought, well, you were like my biggest cheerleader 3 years ago. And maybe it was just because she was proud to see me stand up to, you know, the Capitol, right? The law enforcement, highest law enforcement official in the state. But same kind of deal. And you know, I never followed up and asked how she voted on it, but, it is interesting. So she's a similar age to your father. And even after rooting for me to succeed and never once saying anything disparaging about the substance of my fight, you know, still was undecided on that ballot question. So I think you're right. I think you've hit the nail on the head. There is a generational component to this, but like so many other things.
Well, no, listen, it's something to keep an eye out for, Jake, because like I said, I mean, we all know, listen, it's December 10th. And, you know, at some point the legislature is going to, you know, have their break. And, you know, you want to hope that it gets done on a legislative perspective before they go on hiatus. And the last thing we need, Jake, is to have this sort of ambiguity or sort of innocuous status that we have currently and not get clarity long before the new year. I mean, the last thing we need to do is have them, you know, up until, I don't know, the 31st of December, which I doubt they'd be working that late in the year anyway, but still, for the sake of argument, it would be really, really scary to see them working the slate where, you know, we're hoping next week, as you mentioned, that legislation does get finalized and signed. But then, Jake, you know, again, if you could just sort of remove yourself from the prosecutorial aspect of your job, and let's just talk regular everyday life, bro. You two guys here, you know, shooting the breeze. I'm also concerned, man, because Trenton doesn't always give me the utmost of confidence when it comes to spending and taxes. And when I hear Trenton say, oh, my God, this is a new revenue stream, and, oh, this is great, where, you know, whatever revenues we generate, yeah, they'll go to, you know, public school districts that aren't funded as well, and maybe that'll help them. Jake, I've heard this over and over again. I'm a little older than you, brother. And I've heard this, you know, the gas tax was supposed to do A, B, and C. It has yet to do that, or this tax or that tax. And it just worries me when Trenton salivates over a new revenue stream because it just seems like it never goes to where it's supposed to. That's the other half of me that's just terrified about this, Jake. Do you share that sentiment, or how do you look at it?
Sure. No, I guess. Yeah, and to add to that list, I mean, I was probably in high school, but I think in the 90s, Whitman sold us some similar bill of goods on Easy Pass, was supposed to generate revenue, and in turn, we ended up losing revenue, I think. So, yeah, and look, the progressive advocates certainly have dominated where that revenue will go. So I don't know that there'll be any revenue in the general treasury the way that this might have initially been conceived. But yeah, I am as skeptical as you on the happy ending that this is that we're supposed to buy into.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, again, I look forward to having you back on in the new year at some point. Hopefully, you know, we'll talk about updates. We'll talk about hopefully how the new law has taken effect. Jake, going back to Jersey City now, you were in the headlines last week, and a little bit of a disclaimer. It was actually kind of funny because when we last spoke on my local podcast, I had, because of friends of mine that I know in the organization, I did receive an invite to the Maritime Park restaurant. I knew about this event. I knew about it. I was not able to go because of just having to be home and work on things. I had to grade papers, I mean, exams online. I had to work on content for my Real Talk show with Eisen and Jay. So I quite frankly was just like, you know what? I'd like to go. I love Matt Goetz. I know the president of the organization, Andre Katsimatidis, and I was like, you know what? I got my phone was blowing up at night. Hey, Fernando, where are you? Yeah, what's up? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I can't make it. And it got in the headlines, Dick, because apparently the New York Young Republican Club, they would not be able to have their winter gala. And I don't want to get overly political here because I can go to town all day on Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo and how horrendous they are as a governor and mayor, but they make the decision to go across the Hudson to come to Jersey City for their winter gala. And it seems though, Jake, and again, I don't know how much legally you can disclose because maybe it's an ongoing investigation or it's an ongoing matter, but according to different sources I talked to, it seems like people are telling me, hey, state police were on the scene. The state police were present. State police were there, apparently trying to make sure guidelines were followed and everything else. And it sounds like they were. But the very next morning after the event, Mayor Fulop voices displeasure about what happened. I know that apparently you were on the news feed, you know, on social media. Apparently you had replied to someone's tweet in terms of one of the guests kind of thinking he's sticking to Governor Cuomo, which, I mean, I don't think is a bad thing because I think he's an awful governor, but that's another story. But you took it to the extent of letting that person know, well, guess what? You're not in New York. You're in Jersey City. And essentially, the context is you're in my jurisdiction. What's been the reception to that, and what can you tell us, if anything, about what's gone on with that facility? What's the city been doing? What's your office been doing since this gala took place last week in at the Maritime Park in near Liberty State Park?
Well, I will say that it was fun to go viral, which it and I am left with the impression that they thought they were on New York soil, and it was fun to point out that they weren't with some Jersey pride and some subject matter jurisdiction pride, spoken like a nerdy lawyer. But as you know, that is state park land. We do have health subject matter jurisdiction there, and so our health department responded and ordered the venue closed and until they submitted an operational plan indicating they would follow the governor's executive orders. We have not received a plan yet, but I'll leave it there because obviously it is still ongoing. We were originally looped in by the state park police to assist their police with the law enforcement end. Obviously, with their permission, we can enter state land and assist. And then it turned out over the weekend, the attorney general apparently took over the investigation. So the state park police are not involved at this point. So the law enforcement end will be handled by Trenton. So I can't speak to that. But I will say the one thing I'm comfortable saying is the notion that state police were on site, which we've been seeing a lot said on Twitter and said to media outlets, is very, very false. One, state police do not patrol Liberty State Park. And two, I spoke to the sergeant of the park, as well as two officers that were on site Thursday evening. They were at the venue, but only in the parking lot to manage anticipated left-leaning protesters. And so that their detail was unrelated to COVID and unrelated to the interior of the venue. So that is the fact check on that. And that's kind of where we stand on this issue. And I'll just note, it's another example where the governor gave Jersey City a pat on the back, because I do think under the leadership of this mayor, we've been one of the strongest municipalities in the state, if not the strongest, on responding to this pandemic, both within the parameters of the governor's executive orders, but also with a thoughtful approach that go hard on the violators. First and foremost, tries to educate offenders. And when that doesn't work, we are hard on the violators. And, but we also try to let the businesses that are following the rules operate, keep their workforces employed, serve their customers, our residents. So that's kind of how we look at the Liberty State Park situation from last week at this moment.
Now, Jake, let me ask you the following, and let's sort of separate our professions for a minute. Let's just sort of look at it as we're two guys at a Starbucks having a coffee. I mean, I know we can't do that indoors per se, but let's just theoretically talk about being outdoors at a cafe. Let's just say we're two guys shooting the breeze, because I can tell you I got tons of texts the following day from people and DMs saying, Fernando, and let me pose a scenario to you, Jake. Again, just if you could take off your prosecutorial hat for a moment and let's just sort of look at it, two regular guys talking without getting overly political or ideological. I got a lot of text, Jake, the next day saying to me, okay, it seems like maybe they were trying to spike Governor Cuomo and de Blasio, and maybe they were just trying to get attention, okay, et cetera. But, Jake, a lot of people would just turn around and say to me, you know what, during the summer, in June, when there were people protesting and gathered, and I think almost 1,000 people maybe gathered in front of City Hall on Grove Street during June, when everyone was, that was all the fad, right? BLM, Black Lives Matter, and yes, some people had masks, some people didn't. There wasn't a lot of social distancing, whatever. Someone might just turn around and say, Jake, the mayor and maybe the city didn't so much have a problem with that per se. And you can make a case that there's plenty of videos and pictures to go around that people were not socially distant. People were not everybody was wearing masks, some were. And it was okay because, it's a cause that maybe some in the city sympathize with and whatever. But meanwhile, an organization comes to celebrate their winter gala, and obviously because it's on the opposite end of the spectrum, they're, the governor or the city maybe is looking down on them. Do you understand where people might just turn around and say, hey, this is kind of hypocritical here, because in June, nobody was receiving summonses, nobody was getting cited, and because it was Black Lives Matter and BLM and this and that, and people are woke, and some people might turn around and say, Jake, hey, I don't know, this kind of smells a little bit like hypocrisy in the air. Have you heard that? And what would you respond to people that would make that assertion?
I have not heard that in a Jersey City sense. I will say I'm aware of larger regional conversations about that, about the protests from the early summer. And I can't say that I have been completely satisfied with some of the answers that Mayor de Blasio gave about why COVID protocols might be exempt from that type of a protest. I can't say that I ever was satisfied by that statement. I want to say in Jersey City, I have to politely disagree because I wasn't at the rally in front of City Hall, and I saw tremendous mask compliance, and I would not have, had I been presented with the opportunity to make a decision about non-mask compliance, I would not have tolerated it. But I think our Jersey City protests or demonstrations, I should say, were very different than what you saw in New York and other cities, Philadelphia especially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Ours were peaceful, thoughtful, no disruption to local business, no disruption to pedestrian access to sidewalks, the traffic. Regardless of how you feel about the message, I think Jersey City residents of all stripes should be proud of the way those things were done. The march in the south to the southern end of the city to the South District, the mayor participating in that march, there was tremendous mask compliance. And had there not been, I would have felt the same way I did with what happened at Liberty State Park. I do want to say I think the Liberty State Park is still a little different because I don't like to paint with broad brushes, but there does seem to be this notion on that side of the political spectrum that, look, and I kind of lay this at our president's feet, mask wearing has been politicized. And the intention behind those, in my view, the pictures and the posing and what was shared on the internet was an intentional, let me take off my mask and sort of turn my nose up to the governor of New York, the governor of New Jersey, if they did know where they were, and to my boss, the mayor. And so we really couldn't stand for that because it would show weakness. It would show by enforcing Thursday night, the same way as we would in any other situation, we showed that politics does not come into our enforcement. And if we hadn't taken action, I think there's a lot of other venues in Jersey City that would have felt like the city was letting its guard down. So I think we did the right thing coming out early, and I hope Trenton makes the appropriate decisions and investigations as it's their case now. But I just have to politely disagree. I think I hear what you're saying in a regional sense because some of those answers from elected officials did not satisfy me. But luckily we weren't presented with that in Jersey City because I think our demonstrations were considerably different than what we saw in other parts of the country.
Oh, no, Jake, listen, absolutely. And thankfully they were. I mean, because what happened in Philadelphia was a disgrace. What happened in New York City has been a disgrace. But you're absolutely right. They were peaceful. They were organized. There was an exponential amount of decorum. There's no question. But, you know, Jake, again, regular guys you're talking, you know, the optics to some people, it's like, hey, it's okay. Yeah, you can be wearing masks all you want. But there's still a big crowd there. And, like, to some people, Jake, the optic is, oh, well, there's a whole big crowd in front of City Hall on Grove Street. And, yep, nobody had a problem with that. But if people want to gather for outdoor dining or, you know, all the talking points you've heard this year, Jake, from the summer up until the present, like, the optics are there. And for some people, you know, that's how they're going to feel. And I think that this is what makes this issue so divisive, I would argue, maybe. I don't know. How do you feel?
I think, you know, like anything else, I think these are conversations happening between the far, this notion of unequal enforcement on this issue. I think these are conversations happening, you know, among the far left and the far right more and more in this country, and it's happening more and more locally. And I think there's a large portion of New Jerseyans and Americans and Jersey Cityans that probably aren't connecting these dots the way that you and I might, because it's our business too.
Sure.
And so I just think it's the two ends casting stones at each other. And I think the everyday Jersey Cityan, New Jerseyan, and American is putting on their masks and just not listening to this noise between the far left and the far right. Pointing fingers at each other and all that. So
that's
where I'll leave that one.
No, that's a fair observation. Absolutely. Same with COVID, Jake, obviously during the height of COVID, I know that you and your office were very, very proactive in sniffing out, price gouging and sniffing out, you know, really shady business practices by business owners at the beginning of the pandemic when we really didn't know what was going on. We didn't know what we know now about the virus and everything else. But, you know, your office was really proactive in going after businesses. And I remember, you know, one of the moments, segments, you know, going viral. I mean, even the mayor was there present, if I'm not mistaken, when you and your office made a point to go after these businesses and hold them accountable, because I thought it was reprehensible that these business owners during a pandemic are trying to gouge prices. They're trying to just, you know, at the expense of people who at the time were being laid off or were unsure what was going on economically. So kudos to you, man, for being that proactive along with your department and the task force. And I know that during the fall, it was reported on multiple media outlets that the Jersey City Quality of Life Task Force can now become a new division under the Public Safety Department. What can you tell our listeners today about how that's expanded, what's been the evolution, and where does it stand today?
Sure. I'd love to talk about that. And you might eventually have to cut me off because I could talk about that till the morning. We were, you know, first of all, so for background, the May and the public safety director moved enforcement of COVID-19 restrictions under my office, as you indicated, and through the support of our police chief and our public safety director, there is a quality of life police unit assigned to my office. Four police officers, a lieutenant and three officers who are quality of life officers, and they assist our office in investigations or bench warrant execution, but they also are almost like community relations officers. And they were tasked with the daily follow-ups of COVID violations, which I decided to run through our resident response center because residents were already familiar how to report concerns to that center. So we had a very tight system in place where, you know, and we pushed this out through social media, if somebody saw something, to say something, and it would go to our resident response center, and then it would go to this quality of life unit with myself in the loop. And while see something, say something might have sort of a spooky connotation because we've seen it on public transportation, in this instance, we then led with education because we knew that if we went around just summoning businesses, we were going to lose trust and buy-in from businesses, which were hurting enough as it was, and then we would eventually lose the trust of the residents because, you know, a lot of our residents are employed by Jersey City businesses. So every business, unless it was a completely egregious situation, was advised first and educated. And the executive orders were hard to digest, and they were coming out quickly, and they're still coming out quickly. And it's not one rolling executive order that updates. It's a new executive order for new topic. And to navigate them, there's a lot of cross-referencing. So we would always educate a business, and then we would follow up and do spot checks, whether it was price gouging, mask compliance, capacity enforcement. And only if we had to go back would we do summonses. So it was very popular. It was a great system, the way we had it between the resident response center and the officers in my office. The mayor was very proud of it, and as were our public safety leadership. And it was interesting because other municipalities like Newark and like even the Attorney General would tweet and press release each day how many summonses they issued enforcing COVID-19. And sort of the message from the mayor and I was we were tweeting how many conversations we had with businesses. And I don't want anyone listening to think that means we are like soft on violators, but it's practical because you're separating the worst from the uneducated, right? So we educate you, you do it the right way, fine. But we educate you and then you still don't follow along. Well, then we're going to really come down hard on you because we have way less summonses and we can focus on the few that are meaningful. So the mayor said, let's make this a permanent thing. Let's combine the resident response center, the municipal prosecutor's office, and Jersey City is unique in that we have 7 code enforcement offices. Most cities in New Jersey as well as the country have 1. So let's combine as many of those offices as we can. We were able to take 3 that enforce the local ordinances, the rest enforce state administrative code, and combine that into 1 office with quality of life inspectors. And we pitched it to the council, and at a vote of 7-2, it passed, not without controversy and pushback from a very small but loud segment of folks, some of which I assume live in Jersey City, but I'm not confident to say that they all do. but the council did the right thing. And I was very adamant that it belonged under public safety because, you know, there was a conversation happening about police reform, which is needed. And I think we all know the slogan that went around, and I think a better slogan would have been rethink police. And, you know, by bringing this problem solving educating entity under public safety, we were sort of saying, hey, this is the part of the city that responds to residents, goes where residents want enforcement, want their quality of life enhanced. So why wouldn't we move that under public safety? And why wouldn't we say, hey, police and public safety are in the business of solving problems proactively, not just reactively? So I was really proud of that message, and that's how we got there. And January 1, this division will start to kick off. There's a lot to do to get it together, both in terms of housing all these inspectors and consolidating fleets of vehicles into one. But that will kick off in January, and I'm very excited for it. I'm very proud of how we got there.
Well, it's certainly something that's very commendable, and it shows your commitment to Jersey residents, Jake, and how invested you are in your position. And speaking of your position, I know that speaking with different municipal prosecutors up here where I live in North Hudson, one of the chief ones here is a very good friend of mine in North Hudson, in townships of North Bergen and Union City. For our audience that isn't aware of what the process is this just a yearly appointment? Is it something that is done maybe every 2 years? What can you share with us about how the process is in Jersey City compared to other municipalities who have the exact same title that you do, again, at the municipal level, but maybe are appointed differently or their longevity is different?
So it's dictated by state statute, so it is the same across the country, or the state, which is problematic for a few reasons, because, you know, there are small towns that have court one night a week in the council chambers. They actually did a study 2 years ago. There's about 5 municipal courts in the state that over the year of the study, I think it was 2018 or 2017, never had a single session because no tickets were written, probably small towns in the, you know, rural areas. And so, you know, Jersey City is one of, I believe, 2 or 3 full-time prosecutor's offices. I have 10 lawyers in my office, as well as staff and per diem attorneys from the law department that handle some traffic sessions at night. But I have the same process as any other municipal prosecutor, and that is an annual appointment. You can stay as a holdover. In that 1 year, though, you can only be removed by a vote of the council, which was an interesting point during the marijuana fight, because there really was no way the attorney general or the county prosecutor could get rid of me. They could just sort of, you know, clip my wings and take some of my cases, but they could not remove me as prosecutor. And there's a lot of court reform discussions in New Jersey that were louder 3 years ago, and it's one of the reasons why I sought this job. They seem to have kind of fallen on the back burner, but one of the problems is that municipal prosecutors have a 1-year appointment, and I believe a working group did propose making that a 3-year appointment. County prosecutors are on a 6-year appointment. And the reason having a longer appointment is good is more for the one night a week municipal prosecutors, because in a small town, I'm very blessed to have the support of a mayor like Fulop, who believes in what I'm doing and trusts my judgment and lets me do my job and trusts that I'm going to do it in a way that carries the ball forward. But I've got, you know, an operational budget and staff and lawyers and a police unit assigned in my office. So my job looks very differently than the one night a week prosecutor, but they're both important jobs. And so think about the one night a week municipal prosecutor who needs to call. First of all, they're usually not paid well. Sometimes they have to bring their own liability insurance. They have to run discovery fulfillment through their private law firms. Just all sorts of issues. So my hat's off to the people that still do that work, even in the face of how the municipalities don't make it easy. But you're in the courtroom, you're trying to call balls and strikes. You've got a small police force that's civil service. You've got a police chief that's likely civil service in these small towns, meaning insulated from removal. You have a judge who's on a 3-year appointment. There's talk of making municipal judges on 5-year appointments. And you're a municipal prosecutor that every year has to go to the mayor and say, hey, reappoint me. So if you have a string of bad summonses from police or code inspectors, or your priorities are different, maybe you were on board with legalization before your mayor, or you were opposed to legalization and your mayor was for it, you do not have the independence to call balls and strikes, because in 12 months or less, you've got to go hat in hand and ask for your job again. And there's probably 20 lawyers donating to that mayor who would love that one night a week job. So it needs to be a longer term for me and the one night a week guys and gals, because you need that insulation. You need to be able to call balls and strikes without fear of having to ask for your job again or offending police chiefs or judges or mayors. And so I really hope that that comes around, not so much for my sake, but for those other prosecutors that may not enjoy, you know, all the resources and independence that I have.
Jake, that's great clarity there, and I'm sure my listeners appreciate that. For anyone that obviously is either in law school now or practicing law, certainly I think that's a great clarification you just gave us. We know how fulfilling the job is, Jake. What makes it laborious?
What makes it hard for me or in general?
Yeah, well, I mean,
I love it.
We know it's fulfilling, but there has to be days like any profession where it can be laborious and grueling or agonizing or aggravating. You have to get those days, man. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I think for me it's budgeting and getting resources from the city, but I'm probably the only municipal prosecutor that has the luxury of that problem. That's a good problem to have, to have staff and lawyers and mandates from City Hall to move the needle forward on community policing or tenants' rights, right? Cracking down on landlords that don't make repairs. I think on a more micro level, something that probably – look, I have 10 assistant prosecutors under me, and their day-to-day is a lot different than mine because they're in the court right now. They're virtually in the court. It's got to be the volume. Municipal court obviously handles – parking, which prosecutors don't stand up on because they're actually civil offenses. But just to give you a sense of the volume in municipal courts, but they also handle traffic, right? Driving under the influence, code, which is my sort of sweet spot, because I think code is what, you know, keeps fights blight and stands up for tenants, and peace and good order, right? Disturbing the peace is a code issue. But then also criminal, right? I've said to you before, Jersey likes to make things complicated. Every other state in the country calls a misdemeanor a misdemeanor. We call a misdemeanor an offense. So we have misdemeanor jurisdiction. Quite often, those are good, meaningful cases. We have the resources to prosecute them. Like, for example, we get a lot of domestic violence. We have a tremendous domestic violence program that really stands up for victims and then also makes an effort to correct the behavior of offenders. We get a lot of package theft cases, which even though I'm a former public defender, I do not let my APs dismiss or downgrade those package theft cases without my approval. And then quite often county prosecutors can, or their staffs can, downgrade felonies, or we call them crimes, to the misdemeanor level. Sometimes they do that because it's the right thing to do. Sometimes I think they do that across the state because they'd rather downgrade and punt it than have the dismissal on their hands. So there's a lot for my prosecutors to handle. On the criminal end, there's a lot that they need to wade through and say, hey, was this downgraded because it belongs here, or was this downgraded because they didn't want to do the dismissal? And the volume doesn't stop. In Jersey City, is the highest volume summons for summons courthouse in the state of any level. And the backlog right now across the state is trials are suspended unless the defendant consents to a virtual trial. No defendants are consenting to virtual trials. The Chief Justice has ordered that municipal courts cannot issue bench warrants. So so there is no incentive to come to court. And that might be fine on a traffic offense, but I don't know that that makes sense on a criminal or code sense, at least for landlord type issues or bad actor businesses type issues. You know, obviously a drinking in public or a disorderly group, that I could see that being held over till the pandemic's over, but there are things with urgency in municipal court. So to have that volume and to right now have that backlog and the inability to issue a bench warrant, that's probably what drives my prosecutors that are on the front line crazy. And I'm sure that's what a lot of the municipal prosecutors who are an army of one in their municipality are probably weighed down by.
Well, Jake, again, I've gotten to know you for a while. I knew you when you were running as a candidate for city council 4 years ago, and
right.
I've gotten to know
right.
you in the time since then. And certainly, you know, listen, A, you're, you know, you have like this sort of encyclopedic knowledge of the law, which just I can tell is just it comes so easy for you. So I'm sure many people listening are just envious that this is just like it seems like you can recite case law in your sleep. I mean, that's just sort of the vibe I get from you and over time from talking to you. And
doesn't everybody?
I don't know. I mean, listen, even as an academic, I know, even as an academic, I struggle with some policies I probably learned in grad school. But again, you know, you're such a wealth of knowledge, man, when it comes to the law. And certainly, I think you have, you know, the fluidity and just the way you convey it, I think makes it easy to talk to you on the air, especially for our audience that maybe looks at the law and is maybe intimidated by it or seems that it's very overwhelming. You say it with such grace and such suave that it's definitely admirable. And I could have you on the show for like two more hours and still not get through everything. But before I let you go here, Jake, again, I'm going to, you know, just say, A, keep up the great work, man. You're certainly a testament to the office there in Jersey City. Clearly, Mayor Phillip is very happy with you. If he isn't, I don't know what he'd be expecting, because you're doing really, really admirable work. So, again, stay the course. B, again, you know, you're a gentleman and very gracious to come on, not just this podcast, but my local podcast in Hudson County to really give our listeners a perspective of how demanding this job is. Because as you alluded to, obviously your job is very different than the one night a week municipal prosecutor that maybe works in other parts of Hudson County or Bergen, all the way in South Jersey, maybe in more rural areas where maybe it's once every 2 weeks, who knows? So the idea that we've learned how rigorous your job is, how demanding it is, but you handle it with such grace, man. And I really applaud that with you. So I wanted to say that. And then C, I always give my guests, or I try to at least give them the floor, because I've been the one asking questions, man. But now I'll give you the floor, counselor. If you have a question for me, you want to pick my brain, hey, what you got for me?
Wow, and I had that really good question for you last time we spoke about your favorite whack packer. And I don't have, and that just kind of came up because you mentioned Howard Stern during our conversation. I wish I had something equally as interesting to ask you now. I'll say this, you know, when we scheduled our talks, I said I wanted to talk about police reform, and I think you're slowly realizing I'm not, but I think maybe about a year ago you might have filed me under far left. Dare I say snowflake, but I said, you know, let's talk police reform, because I think we could find common ground and have common ground. And I think the conversation on police reform needs to start from a point of common ground. And so I guess I wanted to ask you, or invite you to ask me more about, where do you see police reform in New Jersey being needed? Where do you think it's not needed? Do you see where the quality of life objective sort of comes in and solves some concerns on the right and on the left? I was just, you know, I know you follow it, because I follow you on social media. I know you pay attention to it. I was just curious if you had any final thoughts on where we're at in New Jersey, on if or not, whether we need to rethink policing and how we're doing on that front.
Well, let me say this, and again, I'm just speaking as an academic. I don't have a fundamental knowledge of the law like you do, but, and this is something that might shock you because I've actually talked about it on, with other guests. You know, obviously I'm a, you know, I think you, because you follow me on social media, I think you know I'm a center-right person, but here's a position I think that will shock a lot of people. Because having worked in the criminal justice system before entering academia, you know, I worked in our jails, I worked in our courts, I worked with police departments, so I've seen a little bit of everything. And I would venture to guess, again, this is just as a layman and as a regular guy, I don't see the problem with ending qualified immunity. Because I really, really think, and I've done some research on this, Jake, I think if we found a way to, I'm not, maybe not terminate it completely, but if we really found a way to minimize it, I think that might put a lot of, I think it'll put a good pressure on departments and for officers specifically, act more responsibly. I think if you know ahead of time that qualified immunity is not going to be there, you might show better judgment in instances where, I get it, they're momentary decisions, you have seconds to react. But I think that if you go through better training, and I would advocate two things. I would advocate, I don't see what's wrong with ending qualified immunity. I think that might be a good thing. And B, I think the training at academies, because again, before, you know, I worked in corrections, so I went to the academy down south in down South Jersey, so I know what the rigors are. I don't see why training at academies shouldn't be longer. You know, I think they're like 3 to 4 months now. Why not make them 6 months? I think if we try to eliminate every possible window of, you know, where impropriety can occur and where we can see bad judgment occurring, I think that's a good thing, Jake. And I know a lot of my conservative media people or other people talk to me, oh, wow. A lot of my cop friends say, wow, why would you end qualified immunity? Like, you're not an attorney. You're not qualified to speak on this. I don't think I have to be an attorney, Jake. I think as a regular guy doing research,
yeah.
I think it's a good step in the right direction. Now, again, you're the attorney. You can tell me whether that's, hey, Fernando, that's not realistic, or B, maybe it is. I would argue if those two things are pursued, Jake, I think that would be monumentally beneficial in really shaving down the layers and saying, you know what, this is how we get to police reform, bro.
Absolutely. You know, training, that was one of my points. I think the other side of the coin too is uniform use of force standards, right, across states, if not the whole country, because the more uniform we are, the easier it is to train, because each municipality or each state isn't setting their own standards. Then it's a national language and a national standard, and it's easier to train cadets with or retrain existing officers. I think with clear uniform standards for use of force, because when you look, it's interesting because some people think qualified immunity is all or nothing, and you're saying let's find where to draw that line, when it should apply and where it shouldn't. And I think the challenge is,
Jake, is that realistic though? Again, as a regular guy, is that realistic? Can we do that?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to give it like a thumbs up or thumbs down, say yes or no,
sure,
because
sure.
It's more nuanced than that.
Sure.
Because where you need to draw the line, and where you need to draw that line is when you're a police officer, you're making a split second decision that could be the difference between your life and death, or an innocent bystander's life or death, or an excessive use of force on a person of interest's life and death, for lack of a better word, at the top of my head. And people make their own life and death decisions very quickly and with instinct. If you think you're being fired at, I don't think there's an officer in the country that could live with opening fire and then finding out that they weren't under fire, right? Those types of mistakes, those tragic stories. So if you're going to put the line somewhere in the middle, you've already answered your own question about how that works. Good training. And the only thing I would add is clear, uniform use of force so that there's no debate There's no discussion among different corners of the country. It keeps politics out of it. It keeps ideology out of it. And I think that's how you could get to somewhere. I'm not endorsing one view or the other, but I think if you were going to land in the middle or draw that line somewhere in between the two ends, that's how you would do it effectively. So that's how I think you can get to the type of thing you might be describing.
And again, I hope we can get there. And certainly in the new year, Jake, I'd love to have you back on. We can talk more about police reform because, you know, in one shape, way, or form, depending on what happens. I mean, again, I'm not an attorney, and I stopped watching cable news after Election Day because I don't want to be just inundated with everything, this and that. And, you know, we'll see who is taking the oath of office on January 20th. But regardless, we know that these are topics that are not going away when it comes to police reform. And I'm with you. I think you mentioned it during the broadcast that, you know, the term defund the police became a very polarizing marketing slogan. And it was politicized, and I think that, you know, it exacerbated already this climate of tribalism that we're living in, which we are. We've been living in political tribalism for many, many years now. I would argue it's probably been for the last 20 years due to the internet, the evolution of the internet, and the rise of social media. So I would argue that that's probably contributed to it. But this year, you know, the cries for defund the police, I think, you know, again, as an academic, and I'm a policy guy, I'm a policy nerd, you know, if you want to enact policy reform, it's all about presentation, and it's all about verbiage. And when you don't verbalize a message properly, and you don't itemize it correctly, it leaves it prone and susceptible to what we saw, Jake. We saw it being politicized. Again, if you refer to defund the police the way it was politicized, let's be honest, you were sort of labeled, oh, you're a leftist, you're this, you're that. And if you, you know, believe in, you know, Blue Lives Matter or preserve the police, then you are someone who tend to be conservative or on the right. And I think we can have that conversation where we can come in the middle, man, where,
yep,
you know, yes, are there bad cops? Absolutely. I grew up, you know, with bad cops like we all did. But are men and women in blue predominantly good people? Yes. I work with police departments every year when it comes to my philanthropy. The PBA right here in Union City where I live, we're partners on breast cancer. I partner with other PBAs. And, you know, I have a positive view of the police. Does that mean that there aren't bad apples? Jake, there are bad professors. There are bad attorneys. There are bad accountants.
Yep.
There are bad pharmacists. I mean, let's be honest. There are bad apples in every profession. It just, unfortunately, it's, you know, police officers face the largest of scrutiny because their decisions tend to be, and the consequences of them tend to be much more instantaneous than a bad attorney or a bad professor, you know? So I think that's something we should definitely keep an eye on. And I look forward to having you back on in the new year, man. We definitely want to be able to discuss this more and, you know, dissect what's going on, hopefully with marijuana. Are you up for that in the new year?
100%. Tell me when and where.
All right, brother. Listen, stay safe. Happy holidays to you. Merry Christmas. And, you know, keep up the good work, Jake. And again, you know, Mayor Phillip is listening. I hope you can plug this episode. I think we've had a great, great conversation. You know, the city council and the mayor, they should listen. Whenever state law can change, you should be in this position for as long as you want it, man. You're that good at it. So God bless you, Jake.
Oh, thank you. You're keep up your good work too. And also enjoy Christmas, the holidays, the new year, the works as well.
And listen, let's grab a beer or a coffee. Maybe when it's a little warmer or whenever, we can do that in the new year. Let's do that. Okay.
Absolutely. As long as we comply with all standing executive orders.
That's right. There you go. Jake, stay safe, man. Take care. God bless you, bro.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
You too. Bye.
Take care. Folks, what a good episode today here on Politically Direct with the Chief Prosecutor of Jersey City, Jake. Sorry about that, folks. Again, a great episode with the Chief Prosecutor of Jersey City there, Jake Hudnut. And I can't say enough, ladies and gentlemen, about what a treat he is to have on the air because, you know, Jake, again, as I alluded to on the broadcast, you know, I got to know Jake when he was running for city council in downtown Jersey City, in Ward E. If anyone knows about Jersey City, it's the downtown section, near Grove Street, near the Pass Train, near, you know, financial area and everything, Exchange Place. And I remember interviewing Jake, again, in the fall of 2017. And he came across very fluid, very just personable. And I know that, he was already an accomplished attorney. And then when I read the news cycle that Jake was going to be appointed as chief prosecutor in Jersey City, I was like, wow, that's a great hire by Stephen Phillips. So a good job there by him. And I can't say enough really about, you know, what it means to Jersey residents to have public servant like him, because he really cares. You know, he, you know, as he alluded to, when it comes to the position of chief prosecutor, and I'm not trying to, you know, downgrade anybody or, you know, throw water on them, but folks, in a lot of municipalities, and whether it be in Hudson County or Bergen or the other 19 counties in New Jersey, oftentimes chief prosecutors are not a full-time job. Okay, as Jake alluded to, they tend to be working perhaps once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks. It depends on the volume, right, of cases and everything else. So, you know, Jake doesn't have that advantage. Jake in Jersey City, obviously, as he alluded to, has a staff of 10 attorneys. He obviously has to work with a budget that's provided to him by the city council, right, that's signed by the mayor. So, you know, Jake's job is, I mean, infinitely much more difficult and time-consuming and laborious. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but laborious in the sense of, hey, he has to get things done with the staff, and he has volume, and he's got to work within the parameters that he has. And I think that that's tough, you know, and that's tough on him, but I think he handles it, as you can tell, he handles it like with grace. I mean, it's almost like you can just do this in his sleep. That's how you can tell how easy the law comes to Jake. So, you know, again, a great job by him. And certainly I think a great conversation with Jake Hudnut, the chief prosecutor of Jersey City, here today on the podcast. But I'll tell you, this is why I enjoy talking to him and all my other guests, because I get you those exclusives that you do not hear anywhere else. Well, folks, that's our show for this week. I do want to thank once again the chief municipal prosecutor out of Jersey City, Jake Hudnut, for a wonderful conversation. Certainly, you can listen to the episode in its entirety if you missed it, or if you maybe fast-forwarded too much and you didn't catch all of it in its entirety. Again, check out not just only today's episode, but all the previous ones, www.insidernj.com/podcasts. And, you know, you can listen to not just only Jake, but obviously last week we had MBI Incorporated President Rudy Garcia on the show and other great guests throughout the year. And certainly you can check out once again, www.insidernj.com/podcasts. And you can download them and listen to them anywhere, anytime from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. And again, as a reminder, folks, if you have a topic or suggestion you want to hear about in the coming weeks, do me a favor, write to the show's inbox, which is politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Once again, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Now, don't forget to follow the show on Instagram, as well as my own Instagram, at Professor Fernandy Ribe. A lot of you enjoy my stories, whether it's about politics, pop culture, pro wrestling, sports, anything. I know you watch my stories, you love them, you comment all the time. So I'll keep up entertaining you with that throughout the rest of the year going into 2021. Also, hit me up on Twitter, folks. Certainly, my Twitter feed has blown up in the last few days, as I discussed, you know, sticking up for county executive here in Hudson County, Tom DeGise, up against some of the ridiculous vitriol that he's been subjected to. It's just ridiculous. And, you know, I don't mind, you know, I don't mind being a lone wolf here. I can take the shots. I can give them as well as I can take them. So it's not a big deal. But check me out on Twitter, folks, at Professor F. Uribe. And certainly check out Political Direct on Facebook. We have over 1,000 likes and counting. So I must be doing something right, folks, because the traffic is strong and it has remained strong throughout all of 2020. So you definitely want to do that. Again, as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, you check out Insider NJ by going to www.insidernj.com/podcasts. You can do so from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. Again, www.insidernj.com/podcasts. Again, for all the previous episodes. And of course, you can check out the homepage, www.insidernj.com, for just what I would argue is the best journalism anywhere in the city of New Jersey, folks. It really is with Insider NJ. Starts at the top with our editor-in-chief, Max Pizarro, certainly working its way down to our just amazing columnists, which include Jay Lasseter, Fred Snowflack, Even Alan Steinberg, who sometimes is a little delusional, but I still love you, Alan. I know you do listen to the podcast whenever possible. So, again, keep up the great work, everyone. And certainly, you know, I'm proud to be part of the Insider NJ team since I started doing this show in January of 2018. Well, once again, folks, that's our show for this week. A little programming note, this is our last show of 2020. We'll be taking a little bit break here, as I like to do, Christmas break coming up for the rest of December. As I said, you can listen to all the previous episodes of this year at www.insidernj.com/podcast. So it'd be good to take a break and decompress. I'll be working on scheduling some new guests for 2021. You definitely want to stay tuned on the program's social media pages, and I'll be making announcements about that coming up soon. But folks, I just want to say this before I just go off the air. And, you know, 2020 has been a really tumultuous year. For a lot of us, COVID-19 has ravaged not just where I live in Hudson County, but throughout New Jersey and throughout the country. You know, we've lost family members, we've lost neighbors, colleagues, friends, family. You know, it's been a tough year. It really has hit us hard. And for a lot of us that have had to make adjustments and change, you know, I applaud you all. It has not been an easy year. It's been brutal for a lot of us. I know that as the year is coming to an end, you know, I'm grateful to be alive. I'm grateful that my family right now is healthy. My parents, starting off most importantly with my parents, along with my aunt, my uncle, and their son. You know, I can't say enough about how blessed we all are to be healthy and together, safe and sound. You know, it's been a tough year for our family here, ladies and gentlemen. Losing my grandmother in May when she was just about to turn 102 years old, I mean, was brutal. I can tell you it was devastating for me. The day after my birthday to go through that was just absolutely painstaking. And I'll be honest with you, to this day, I don't know how I didn't lose my mind. Sometimes people just have like a nervous breakdown or they go crazy. I don't know how I held it together. I really just, I think I felt I needed to, for the sake of my family, I think for the sake of everybody around me. But it was hard, man, and it was hard, I'm sure, for all of you that lost loved ones this year, whether it was COVID-related or not. It is just draining, but I'm glad you're all here. I'm glad that you have supported this program as much as you have. The traffic has been strong, certainly all the support on social media. And most importantly, I got to say this to my insider boss, Pete Onelia, who – I know oftentimes I'm a pain in the ass to him, and I know oftentimes, you know, I can be just a nuisance to him, whether it's about making sure my episodes get uploaded or, you know, the emails and the phone calls and the text and the DMs that he gets from people in New Jersey that maybe don't like my show and that object to what I'm saying. You know, I have to be immensely grateful to Pete for overlooking these people, you know, these idiots who make it a point to just complain for the sake of complaining or bitching and moaning because that's just who they are as people. And I can't say enough, Pete, where I really appreciate you believing in me, believing in this program, and not listening to the haters, not listening to the annoying people that say, I hate Fernando. Because I've seen, you know, I know we've had those conversations and people that, and I've seen emails and I've seen direct messages and I've seen texts where people be like, I hate you, Fernando. I think you're a despicable person, blah, blah, blah. You know, I've never let that bother me. As a matter of fact, I think I laugh at it and I actually enjoy it. You know, I love the people that support the show. I love people that listen to the podcast, but I think what I love more is the amount of hate and the haters. I think there's something I take pride in when I know that many people hate me. I think it's something that makes me laugh. It makes me like kind of smile. As much as I enjoy knowing I have so many people that are big supporters, I think I really enjoy the fact that I have so many haters that hate me, that actually put it in writing and say, Fernando, I hate you, and will post it on social media, or will send me an email, or will send me a direct message on Facebook Messenger or Instagram and just be like, Fernando, I think you're a horrible person. I hate you. I'll be honest with you, folks. I read that, and I have to laugh because you know what? They're still listening, so I'm doing something right, you know? But, again, I don't want to digress. I can't say enough about the Insider NJ family, about the Graham family who continues to believe in this show, and Pete Onelli, again, the general manager who, you know, come hell or high water, sink or swim, has said, I believe in this show. And it will return in January, once again, folks, and it will return for 2021. And I'm excited about that. I'm excited at the outreach that I have in New Jersey, at the influence that I have, the fact that, hey, you know, you may not like me, but you have to respect me. And I think based on my standing in New Jersey and based on how I am as a media presence, hey, listen, you don't have to like Fernando Uribe. You don't have to sing my praises, but you sure damn well better respect me because I can be a pain in the ass. And I'll continue being a pain in the ass, folks, because you know what? For you, I do this for all the people. I do this to stick up for you, the regular, everyday guy and gal who just hates our political climate, hates what's going on in New Jersey, and I'm here to expose it, and I'm here to represent you. And I'll continue doing that, folks, in 2021. So, once again, ladies and gentlemen, that's our show for this week, and it's our last show for 2020. Again, I want to thank you all for tuning in throughout the year. Once again, check out all my episodes in its entirety, www.insidernj.com/podcast. And, you know, it's, you know, the results and the traffic speak for themselves. So, again, ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, whether you are doing laundry, walking your dog, for my students that already turned in their final exams online, hey, tune in, and you'll be happy that you did. And never forget, folks, it's real. It's still here. It is the three-time award-winning Politically Direct, brought to you by Insider NJ. Good night, Jersey City. Yes, Hudson County's largest city. Appreciate people tuning in here on the podcast, not just this week, but throughout the year, right here on insidernj.com/podcast via Blog Talk Radio. Folks, have a wonderful holiday season. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Festivus. Happy holidays to everybody. Best wishes for 2021. Have a happy new year. And I'll see you all next year, folks, here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, what we'll keep doing in the new year is we'll keep on talking.